This is very sick, so every time I sit down, this is...
Call the meeting order.
I'll be great chair.
Joint meeting of the Senate Special Committee on AIDS Prevention and the House Health and Social Services Committee. Some of the House members had other commitments tonight. We expect some to straggle as the meeting continues. We're going to open up the meeting today with a presentation by Elizabeth Ward, the Director of the Division of Public Health.
Senator, committee members, I just want to take this opportunity to thank you for the privilege to be able to give you a status report and our recommendations regarding AIDS in Alaska, and we'll quickly turn it over to Dr. John Middow, who is our state epidemiologist, who will be presenting you the information. Thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Okay, Dr. John Middow, state epidemiologist. Dr. Middow.
Thanks very much. I, too, would like to express my thanks for having the privilege to come and address you about the problem of AIDS in Alaska. And we prepared some status report handouts that you have, but rather than go through them point by point, I think I'd like to try to keep my remarks relatively brief, but to try to give a quick overview of our state's AIDS program efforts, but then to focus in on the major changes and challenges that we now face based on what we've learned in the last several years about this disease. We first became aware of the problem in 1981, and we've established reporting and surveillance through the Division of Public Health, and have continued since that time to try to respond to the growing problem and threat of AIDS in Alaska. Up through this time, we've had 34 documented individuals who are Alaskans who have developed AIDS, and we know that at least 20 of those individuals have died of this disease. In addition, through screening with blood tests, we've documented that an additional 140 Alaskans are now known to be infected with the virus that causes AIDS, and that's out of approximately 2,300 Alaskans that we've screened in our state laboratory. But as we've continued to try to address the problem of AIDS, the Division of Public Health established an AIDS task force to establish policies which were developed approximately 15 months ago and have received widespread endorsement related to schools, foster care, daycare, Department of Corrections, hospital facilities, providers of pre-hospital emergency care, and other policies. And we've been very fortunate to this time in the general reception, which has been positive to those policies and their endorsement. In addition, we've established test sites, one, to protect the blood supply, and two, to provide the opportunity to screen individuals for this disease. Our major challenges for the future, though, are summarized in a second handout that we provided for you, and that's what I'd really like to stress. But before getting to that, I'd just like to reiterate some information, which I hope won't be redundant to some of you, but will be helpful in our discussion. AIDS is a syndrome, acquired immunodeficiency syndrome. And by that definition, it's a constellation of symptoms and impairments which, taken together, enable us to identify that a particular individual has the illness that we know as AIDS. But that constellation of syndromes are produced by an impairment in the body's immune function that are caused by infection with the virus. And that virus has undergone numerous changes in nomenclature as more research has been done and more has been learned about it. So it's been known by HTLV-3 or human T-cell lymphotrophic virus and lymph adenopathy-associated virus and now human immunodeficiency virus or HIV. Those are all the same virus, it's just that the terminology has changed. When an individual becomes infected with the virus, it means that the virus has entered the body. Within about 6 to 8 weeks, the body's immune system, recognizing that foreign virus, will produce antibodies to the virus. Those antibodies are what we detect with the blood tests that we do on individuals and is a documentation of the infection with the AIDS virus. But that does not mean that an individual has the illness. In fact, many individuals infected with the virus may live their entire lives with no symptoms whatsoever. Based on our current understanding, we believe that approximately half of all individuals who become infected with the virus will go on to develop the clinical illness known as AIDS. From the time that a virus infects an individual to the time that symptoms occur is known as the incubation period. The problem with AIDS is that the incubation period is very long, usually 3 to 5 years, but it may be as long as 20 or even 30 years. And that means that during all that period of the incubation period, an individual is infected with the virus, can potentially excrete the virus and infect others, but is unaware of that infection because no symptoms have occurred. Now, what's changed? What's happening now? Well, I think I can best summarize it that the medical, public health, professional community is becoming increasingly alarmed about AIDS. It's now estimated that by 1991, 270,000 Americans will have AIDS, will have the symptoms that constitute the illness AIDS. That's more individuals than died in the Korean and Vietnam Wars. It's also estimated that as of this time, 1.5 million Americans are infected with the virus. We believe half of those individuals will go on to develop AIDS and potentially die of AIDS. A few years ago, we believed that the disease was restricted, either because of the virus or additional factors, to high-risk groups, gay, homosexual males, IV drug users primarily, also recipients of multiple blood transfusions like hemophiliacs, but that in fact the disease was thought to require co-infections or other factors. We now know that's not true. The high-risk group designations are extremely important to recognize in understanding the epidemiology, in learning about the virus, its spread, and preventive measures. But this virus is spread based on high-risk behaviors, and the virus has spread dramatically into the heterosexual community. 1.5 million Americans are infected. Additionally, years ago, it was not well appreciated nationally by public health authorities about the number of actively bisexual males. And it's clear that potentially 10% of American males are actively bisexual and have provided a way for the virus to be transmitted into the heterosexual community. As well, it was thought that the virus required additional problems to set up an infection. It's now known that one contact with an infected individual through direct inoculation of the virus into the bloodstream, and the virus requires that direct inoculation, but the methods are IV drug or IV inoculation, or through inoculation from the presence of the virus in semen through deficiencies in the mucosa of the body into the bloodstream, but that a single contact is sufficient for an individual to become infected. Then the other thing that's changed, we had strong belief that our medical technology research could produce a vaccine against this virus. And our hope was that the rapid production of such a vaccine would provide a definitive protection and weapon to stop this virus spread. It's now very clear that such a vaccine, it will not be available for at least 5 years and perhaps 10 years and perhaps longer than that. As well, it's clear that no medication is going to be made available or is on the horizon that will be effective in treating this disease, in reducing the disease transmission, or providing a weapon against it in the next 5 years. There have been no individuals who have recovered after developing AIDS. Once individuals have developed the impaired immune system, have ended up having symptoms, the disease up to this time has been uniformly fatal. Now, the other very important things that have happened is that the Institute of Medicine and the National Research Council of the National Academy of Sciences convened a nationwide grouping of the nation's experts on AIDS and produced this document called Confronting AIDS. It's a definitive, exhaustive work, but as a result of this document, the National Research Council called upon President Reagan to assume personal, forceful leadership in mounting a major response of our country to deal with this incredible epidemic. They called for the government of the United States to spend $1 billion a year, additional revenue annually, for research and $1 billion a year additional revenue for health education and disease prevention education activities. And then Surgeon General Koop, who I think it's worth talking about, was known for being a devout Christian fundamentalist whose appointment as Surgeon General of our country was adamantly fought and opposed by the public health associations and medical community. After reviewing the data on AIDS and the threat to our country, personally authored this report on AIDS, calling for a major effort to provide disease prevention education to all children in America to the lowest grade possible, which he has defined as the third grade. And I think that's quite a dramatic and impressive action on his part. In Alaska, we have had an experience with AIDS very similar to the rest of the country as a whole. By that, the number of cases we've had and the distribution of those cases have been very similar to that described in other states and in national statistics. But we know that there are additional information that we can help use to assess the magnitude of the risk. It's known that 70% of intravenous drug users in New York City and New Jersey presently are infected with the virus. One half of the now 3,000 infants born with AIDS were born to mothers who are IV drug users. In Zaire, 50% of all children 2 years of age are infected with the virus. These figures are staggering. There are now anticipated that in some African countries, the number of deaths attributable to AIDS will be so great to potentially threaten the political and economic stability of the countries because so many educated individuals will die of the disease. Now, in view of the fact that we're not going to have a drug, we're not going to have a vaccine, what do we need to do? And that answer is we need to apply proven, effective public health principles now to control this disease. We know that diseases, infectious diseases, were controlled long before drugs were available historically or vaccines were available. In the 1700s, epidemics of cholera were prevented and disease prevented by applied public health principles. That today is our major weapon against this disease. And the call for action in our nation and here in the state is one we cannot afford to ignore. The next thing is, in a way, we're still fortunate in Alaska. We have a small population, and our past track record in dealing with public health problems is commendable, as evidenced by our work in vaccinating our children in the past and the state's response to hepatitis B. But our bang for our buck is going to be now, because every individual who becomes infected can infect others. And when individuals become infected, they have no way of knowing that. And by behavioral change and responsible personal behavior, this disease transmission can be reduced significantly. I think that we can absolutely be confident that the spread of this disease is inexorable. But we don't want 5 years from now, when we have thousands of cases of AIDS, thousands of people infected, to say we should have done more when we had a better opportunity. Today, we're having calls to our Division of Public Health from school officials, school administrators, community leaders, and individuals throughout the state asking for assistance, asking for core curriculum, asking for help. We're simply unable to respond adequately at this time. In addition, we recently did a survey, a telephone survey through the Institute of Social and Economic Research about Alaskans' knowledge about AIDS. Approximately 98% to 99% of all those interviewed were knowledgeable about AIDS, that AIDS existed, that sexual contact was one way to get it, that sharing a needle with a drug user who had AIDS was a way to get it, or receiving a blood transfusion from an AIDS-infected person was a way to catch AIDS. But there was a tremendous amount of ignorance and anxiety. 44% of those surveyed indicated they personally were afraid that they could get AIDS. 28% incorrectly believed that they can catch AIDS by donating blood, an impossibility. 21% of those surveyed believe that they could catch AIDS by sharing a drinking glass, a glass of water with someone with AIDS. 60% of Alaskans said they wouldn't eat at a restaurant if they thought a food handler at the restaurant might have AIDS. This disease is extremely hard to catch. That's why we have an ability to effectively reduce its transmission. But to do so is going to require a tremendous amount of unified effort statewide in order to respond. Finally, there are additional important issues. The cost of care of patients with AIDS is extremely high. They require numerous expensive medications and support. Generally, many of the individuals with AIDS do not have health insurance, or they have health insurance only while they can work. And when their illness gets severe enough that they can no longer work, they don't have health insurance. Increasingly, health insurers will not underwrite insurance for individuals infected with the virus. Because of that, the cost of care to individuals is staggering and mounting all the time nationally and here in Alaska. And finally, the issues of confidentiality are extremely important in order both to protect individuals as well, of course, as to ensure that we can adequately protect the public. Well, when we say what should we do next, I think that the key issue is to implement the Surgeon General's reports here in Alaska. First off, we need to ensure that all Alaskans have accurate information about this disease and about the behaviors that they can undergo that will reduce the risk of transmission of infection. The next thing we need to do is ensure that we have a viable, accessible, totally trusted program that can do the screening for the presence of infection coupled with adequate counseling so that individuals who are not infected can be specifically counseled about behavioral change to reduce the possibilities that they might become infected, and if individuals are infected, that we can counsel those individuals so they don't infect others, and that we can also contact trace to identify other individuals. I think I'll stop now and ask if you have any questions that I could answer.
Dr. Minow, a couple things have occurred to me. There's been talk about mandatory testing. Is there a value to
the issue of mandatory testing was blown into focus for all of us with major headlines in the papers around the country approximately 4 weeks ago. What actually happened is that the officials at the National Centers for Disease Control had intended to develop a conference of experts around the country by invitation to review a spectrum of all options to attack AIDS in the United States. Those options range from basically doing nothing through mandatory testing and other compulsory things. That was not reported on. It was picked up that they recommended mandatory testing. As a consequence of the publicity that accrued to that potential recommendation, a major conference was held in Atlanta, Georgia on February 24th and 25th. Experts from all over the country attended. Their unanimous conclusion was that mandatory screening has no role at this time in the control or prevention of transmission of the virus. There are many reasons for that. One of the reasons, which is of paramount importance, is that the prevalence, in other words, the number of individuals totally in America infected, is still quite small compared to the total population. The blood tests are not 100% accurate. Because of that, as we apply a blood test that has a certain inaccuracy to a population overall with a low prevalence, the costs of identifying one truly infected individual are exorbitant. In fact, estimated at approximately $100,000 per individual identified. As well, numerous individuals become identified as positive when in fact they aren't because of the problem of false positivity of the test. And the other problem is that individuals are falsely reassured because they may be missed when their blood is tested, and consequently they believe they are not infected when they are. As well, the efforts need to be directed to generic education about this disease and how to prevent it. That's where we're going to make our major inroads, and we have no way to know if someone is not infected one day, are they infected the next day, etc. except by retesting.
What about the safety of the blood supply as of this point?
When the blood test was developed, the primary purpose in the first massive use of it was exactly for that purpose, to protect the nation's blood supply. And in May of 1984, we instituted blood testing in Alaska, and since that time, all donors are screened with the blood test. The purpose of the blood test was to identify anybody that might be infected and not to then allow them to donate the blood. So if it was recognized that false positives could occur, that was a price that was felt to be reasonable to pay so that their blood wouldn't be used even though they weren't infected, a proportion of them, in order that the blood supply would be protected. Today, I think we can say that that program is working very well, both in our urban areas where all of the blood donors are screened, and the rural areas of Alaska where in our walking donor program, the walking donors routinely are screened. In addition, great emphasis has been made to inform individuals who are engaging in high-risk behavior not to donate. Now, we have excellent evidence in this particular problem of AIDS that behavior modification works. The reason is because in the high-risk groups who years ago we identified the AIDS problem, there is surveillance, and that group also had a high incidence of infection with other sexually transmissible diseases that have a very short incubation period. And the prevalence of syphilis and gonorrhea and chlamydia in that group has fallen precipitously, and evidence of changing sexual behaviors and practices among that group. And now, it's important for us to realize that because the incubation period of the disease is so long, if this very day in America all disease transmission stop, we would still see numerous cases appearing for the next 20 years from people who have been infected up to this time. They have the virus, they don't have symptoms. But as they live longer, they're going to develop symptoms. Maybe half of all is infected. So we'll still see the case counts mount. We're going to see that in Alaska, it's going to happen in the nation. But we know that that's not a true, adequate reflection of the effectiveness of education and behavior modification. And when I say education by itself isn't adequate. It's behavioral modification. We have to make individuals aware of the need to reduce risk behaviors.
One of the things I've noticed is that there was a five-year projection done, and it's the Surgeon General, I think, 270,000 cases of AIDS, 170,000 deaths. They don't project the number of potentially infected persons by 1991. They hold the infected persons at 1.5 million today.
Right.
Why aren't they projecting the number of potential infected persons beyond today's?
I don't know why. Right now, we know. I think one of the reasons has to do with the incubation period. Another is the fact that nationally, as efforts are underway and hopefully will be massively increased to reduce behavior, that's what we need to focus on. Not the cases, everybody who's infected. And as we reduce the ability of transmission, then hopefully that's going to reduce the number of new people, and it will, who get infected. Right now it's estimated that for every case, there are between 30 and 50 individuals who are infected with the virus.
And what about a quarantine? That's a question. That's a word you often hear in relation to AIDS.
That a quarantine has been used for various infectious diseases in the past. Diseases that have short incubation periods, diseases that can be diagnosed, and diseases up till very recently for which there are treatments. The problem with quarantine is that it really has no role in the protection of individuals or the reduction of transmission of the virus. Again, because so many individuals are infected, have no knowledge of it, we have no knowledge that they are infected, and the disease is not casually transmitted. Again, it's so important to be clear that we're alarmed by this virus. It's spreading, but there's not a need for panic over casual exposure or contact. excellent studies have been done. Hospital workers who have cared for the thousands of AIDS patients in this nation have never had an AIDS infection among them. There are approximately 800 hospital workers who, in the course of their caring for an individual with AIDS, stuck themselves with a needle contaminated with blood from the AIDS patient. None of them have developed the antibody. None of them have become infected because of the needle stick. In addition, among family members of AIDS patients, there have been no family members who have been found to be infected with the virus unless they themselves were members of high-risk groups. That's extremely important because of the incubation period. The individual in the family who was infected with the virus didn't know that for many years until they became ill. During all that period when they were infected and were excreting the virus, they took no special precautions in their households to avoid the risk of transmission. Again, powerful evidence about the lack of communicability of this virus through casual contact. So we need to reassure the public about that. But we have to respond now to the opportunity to educate all of us about what we can do to reduce the risk of transmission of this virus. And I think it's overwhelmingly important to do it now when we have a better chance to do that, because it's very clear we're going to have no drug that's going to eradicate this virus, that's going to eliminate its infectiousness, and we're going to have no vaccine for at least 5 years and maybe longer. And that's why there is such a movement nationally and in the professional community to try to start by implementing the Surgeon General's recommendations, as well as to increase screening, to increase knowledge of this disease, and to respond now to prevent its further transmission and spread.
Senator Curtillo, is there a question?
It just seemed to me, and I know we had no control of that, but I didn't at this moment, but as long as I had it, that mandatory testing, and I know it would run into all kinds of problems, cultural, political, legal problems. But if there are 1.5 million Americans out there, even though it would cost $100,000 for each one discovered that did have AIDS, there would be that 1.5 million identified, right?
Well, there's thought to be approximately 1.5 million infected,
but
the problem is identifying those individuals and to try to not only identify them, but to change their behavior. And the problem with mandatory testing is that the tests are not accurate enough, and the problems of applying the test do not help in reducing its transmission. It's behavioral modification that's going to reduce transmission. Simply identifying the infection or the absence at one point in time could provide tremendous false assurance, and in fact is going to miss many people who are infected, and is going to falsely identify many people who aren't infected as if they were infected.
What can a state do? What do you suggest this state does is probably the big question. I mean, I recognize we can contribute to a major research program, money, cash. We can do some statistical work in this state, but what else do you suggest that we do?
I think that it's crucial in our state not to delude ourselves that we're going to provide research answers to the solution of AIDS. That's just simply beyond us. But what I think we can do is we can implement the Surgeon General's reports. I think it's crucial that we respond to the growing requests and need for information. We need to develop a comprehensive program through our school systems to enable us to teach about AIDS and risk reduction behaviors throughout Alaska. We also need to increase our ability to screen and counsel individuals in high-risk groups in order to identify those infected, trace their contacts, and to be able to try to work constantly to modify behavior to reduce transmission.
Thank you.
Dr. Middle, you mentioned a curriculum that we you do not have any particular curriculum available at this time. Has the one been developed nationally? Are there instructional materials available for teaching?
We just received this week a core suggested curriculum that was produced by the National Centers for Disease Control. I haven't even had a chance to read it myself yet. I think that what's crucial is to have an appropriate mobilization of our Alaskan fabric of society to examine available data and core curriculum and to determine what are accurate, appropriate information that should be shared with all Alaskans and our children. We have a tremendous opportunity to prevent our kids from unnecessarily dying from this virus. And it's an opportunity that we only have through the application of these proven public health interventions that work. And we're so preoccupied today in our society with technology, with vaccines, and with drugs. We aren't going to have them, but we do have very effective ways to reduce transmission. And every single case prevented is going to have a geometric benefit over years in our state.
Doctor, the state has put in since fiscal year 1982 $1.3 million, and we have received from the federal government $9.9 million for a total of $11 million in the work against the hepatitis B disease in the state of Alaska. What's been the result of the expenditure of that money?
Well, I think that the hepatitis B program is an example of what I think is a remarkable demonstration of the Alaska legislature and the Alaskans and us Alaskans in responding to a major disease epidemic. In hepatitis B, we were fortunate to have an excellent vaccine, albeit an expensive one. I think that the message here is in approximately 30 years, we know of about 45 deaths, which we can directly attributable to hepatitis B infection. Now, we got 20 deaths from AIDS in the last 3 years, and it's very possible that number is going to double in the next year, and it could double in the year after that. And so, in comparison of the amount of expenditure in response to hepatitis B, I think it's helpful to simply view the seriousness of this AIDS epidemic threat to our society.
Senator Curtula.
Just for demonstration purposes is appropriate, but you well know, too, that in the middle 40s, 46, 48, Dr. Ernest Greening was governor of Alaska, working with a friend of mine, Dr. Albright, put together the tuberculosis task force, which ultimately eradicated tuberculosis in the state, which was endemic and epidemic in some areas. So there's another history of state territorial in action.
Absolutely. I'm really familiar with that. In fact, I just read the Thomas Perrin report in 1954, and in one of our projects, we've been looking at death certificates from 1930, 1940, and 1950, and it's absolutely wonderful, the advances in public health that this state has given to its citizens.
I remember a youngster just screaming in the hospital in Palmer dying of tuberculosis, and that's 1940.
Senator Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a few questions for Dr. Madoff. You said that 2,300 Alaskans have been screened. Is that
2,300 in the state's alternate screening program.
What is an alternate screening
program? It was the program that was initially, when the test was made available, its purpose was to protect the blood supply. And the concern was that numerous individuals who were not, in fact, going to donate blood were going to descend on the blood banks as a source of getting the test. Because of that, the quote, alternate test site program was developed to provide an alternate route for individuals to become tested. And that's the program that we now have through our Division of Public Health and the Municipality of Anchorage to provide ready accessibility for access to the blood test. But it's not just the blood test. The blood test is only an adjunct to intervention counseling and contact tracing to reduce infection. And so every individual is provided information both about the test and its limitations, about the virus and its transmission, and about ways to prevent its transmission.
Well, now, through the chair again, of the 2,300 tests, this is a test for the virus or for AIDS?
For the virus.
And what was the result as far as the number of AIDS?
As of January 1st, there were 132, as of now, 140 individuals that we have identified who are infected with the virus.
Now, is that, you kind of touched on this, is that a group that you would think would be more apt to have the virus than the general population? Or less?
Absolutely. We know that. In our interviews and documentation, most of those individuals are self-identified members of the high-risk groups.
People who, for one reason or another, want either knowledge or reassurance or...
Absolutely.
Okay. Now, you mentioned behavioral change. A lot of constituents, I think, don't know what that means. Are you speaking about abstinence or monogamy or in the alternative use of prophylactics, or what is behavioral change?
That's all of those. Clearly, sexual celibacy and abstinence are one of the definitive ways to reduce the risk of acquisition of AIDS. In addition, avoidance of intravenous drug use. And thirdly, for those who are sexually active, there's no question that the use of a condom will prevent and reduce, not potentially prevent, but will certainly reduce the risk of transmission. All of those strategies are important in the prevention of the transmission of this virus.
What do the studies indicate, if you can answer this in a generalization, because I suppose it depends on the particular product, but what do the studies indicate the result is of the use of the condom in terms of its effect or the security one has from using a condom?
It's not 100%, but it's very, very good.
Representative Hanley asked about the curriculum, and I think this is where, which is, I think, a critical question here. Probably everybody in Alaska will agree that people have to be educated. But I
want to get to the condoms in third grade.
Right. I watched Billy Graham last night, and he talked about AIDS, and he has one message that he would give everybody about what the significance of the epidemic is and how to cope with it. And I suppose if Dr. Graham were in third grade, he'd just say no, no, no. That would be education.
Absolutely.
Which is fine as far as it goes. But as I understand it, there are other people who say that at the third grade level we should begin to talk about sexuality and safe sex and this kind of thing. Am I correct in saying this is the debate?
I'd say that certainly is the area that's causing heartburn everywhere in the country. And I think that the crucial fact of the matter is that there are numerous routes that the virus can be transmitted by. We need to inform our children about the virus and how to avoid transmission. We had a meeting with Archbishop Hurley in Anchorage to discuss, because he was concerned and is concerned about this issue. I wouldn't pretend to have the answer as to what a core curriculum should be. I think we need to establish that as Alaskans for our Alaskan children. But I think it's not an issue that's going to go away, and it's not an issue that we can afford to duck. It's one we have to meet squarely head on, and I think the Surgeon General has talked about the need to have explicit information on sexual transmission of this disease. There are many efforts nationwide now to develop materials, films, and core curriculum, and I think those need to be reviewed and then made available.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't want to seem in disagreement or old-fashioned or fuddy-duddy, but let me, all of which I may be, but as a parent, I suppose I have some misgivings about a curriculum for my daughter when she reaches third grade, which is explicit, to be perfectly frank with you. I mean, I suppose, like many parents, we are traditionally inclined to postpone discussions of this matter for as long as possible, and usually it's too long. What is the rationale for saying that this issue has to be dealt with explicitly with 7 or 8 year old children?
Because a lot of third grade and above children are sexually active and are becoming infected with the AIDS virus, and there's no treatment, and there's no vaccine, and if they're infected, a lot of them are going to die. And we need to prevent that. Now, how we go about doing it is something we need to arrive at collectively. But I think we have to do it. We have to determine the best way to go about it.
Let me just say, Senator Joseph, I spoke with Dr. Jerry Crivo this afternoon, and he has also indicated the growing alarm about the menace of the AIDS disease. And he has indicated that he's keeping an open mind regarding the teaching of disease prevention education in the school system. And he is also in a position where he would like to see a curriculum before he were to recommend it to his congregation. But he is alarmed, and he is prepared to work towards trying to find a curriculum that would be acceptable.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I thank you for that information, and I applaud him for being open-minded. I hope I'm open-minded too, but let me put it this way. I think we are terribly concerned as parents, not on the issue of sexuality so much, but let me say that I went to see the movie Platoon a few nights ago, and there were some very young children in the audience, and I'm wondering what we're doing in taking childhood away from kids by having to expose them to all of the ugly realities of life at tender ages, and what that does to them psychologically in terms of their emotional growth. So I hope I'm open-minded too, Doctor, but I think if there's one thing that this committee might do usefully, it's really get wading into this and understanding what the curriculum issues are, and if we have to show some leadership with respect to it, let's do it, but we can probably be pretty sensitive to how our constituents feel about it.
I think it's very important to develop a broad input to that core curriculum. I think that the curriculum obviously needs to be tailored for the age of the child. I think as well, I haven't heard anybody who hasn't emphasized that such a curriculum, the core of it, is the stressing of celibacy, abstinence, responsible behavior. I got two little girls, age 5 and 7, and I'm terrified for them for this disease. And I've been dealing with this for 5 years. And I think I know as much about vaccination and immunology and virology as anybody in the state. And I thought initially that it was quite likely that the technology would produce a vaccine and a drug. But now, with what we know about the makeup of the DNA of this virus and its impact on the immune system, I'm alarmed. The medical community is alarmed. This disease could kill lots of people in this country.
Representative Hanley.
I'm just having kind of mixed feelings here sitting listening to this, because I think when I was on the school board, I think we got to we probably all experienced this, and in my era, things have changed. I think in Anchorage at one time, because we were teaching sex education in eighth grade, but abstinence wasn't one of the things that was even being emphasized. So I guess as I'm listening to this, I'm thinking, could it be? Could we get back to some of the, we're talking about abstinence, we're talking about, the one sexual partner, we're talking about family values. Could we actually get back and incorporate and look at some of the advantages of the family unit and some of the things that we've kind of pretty much, I feel like there's so many attacks on family now and so many groups coming out, looking for advantages for that particular sex or one thing or another, but I don't see things that are strengthening the family unit. And I don't know. I guess I'm wondering, somehow in the curriculum, could we point to the fact that maybe there is some value in one partner and that kind of thing that we pretty much haven't emphasized for a long time with kids and.
A lot of reasons here, some of your legislators, state are considering this may be a method of teaching those values, actually.
Well, I'm kind of wondering as I'm listening to this, we kind of got away from it because it was not the thing to do.
Sure, showing the results of promiscuous and non-monogamous behavior. It may well enforce some other.
That's what
teachings.
I'm wondering, I don't know.
It's possible that it could work as a parallel.
But, Mr. Chairman,
I know it's going to go beyond that, but I'm wondering.
Yeah, sure does. Sure
I know it's going to go beyond that.
When you say that you're concerned or terrified about your own children. And yet, on the other hand, you say that casual contact doesn't produce the virus or transmit the virus. Of course, young children may be susceptible to rape, they may be susceptible to sexual assaults of various kinds, in which they're not voluntary participants, sexual abuse. But if casual contact does not transmit the virus, I assume then that what you are talking about is the assumption that a significant number of 8, 9, 10-year-olds are going to be having intercourse with each other. Is that correct?
I think that's the reality of the situation.
Or 10 and 12-year-olds or something.
One thing that I haven't heard discussed, but I read, for example, recently there was a young boy who contracted AIDS because he was a hemophiliac, and it was about the story in the newspaper focused as much on the reaction of his friends in the classroom, and it didn't talk about his family. But the thing you don't hear very much about when you talk about AIDS and you talk about what's being done in the danger is the effect it has on other people. And if a small percentage of people presently have it, the number of people who are indirectly affected and go through the grieving process and go through the loss, that is a much larger number. What is being done and what can be done to help all the people who have an emotional investment in the person who has AIDS? Do they require special kind of counseling? What should we do with them?
You know, I think that's one of the very critical unmet needs nationally and in our state, because at this time, not only are there serious problems in the provision of medical or financing of medical services for the patient, but there are a litany of tragedies of family and loved ones involved in that setting for which insurance policies or whatever simply don't cover that kind of support, counseling, and service. This disease is doing everything. I mean, there are monogamous heterosexual couples where one person is coming down with AIDS. They've had no extramarital sexual contacts for the 8 or 9 years of their marriage, but they were infected 10 years ago by a previous partner. The virus is a very scary virus in epidemiology because of the long latency period and because of the fact that we don't have a cure and we don't have a vaccine.
But when we say 10 years ago, you know, as I understand it, even in the gay community in San Francisco, there was only like a 1% infection rate from 1970.
That's correct.
So there wasn't a whole lot of potential to contract the disease 10 years ago.
That's correct. And the disease, and again, you see, initially, the assumptions based on the epidemiology were that the disease was confined to high-risk groups with basically very unusual sexual practices, which provided a great opportunity for transmission of the virus into the bloodstream. What is now clear, with 1.5 million Americans infected and numerous heterosexual cases, is that the disease is spreading, that these high-risk groups are important in epidemiology and understanding the disease, but that we're not talking about high-risk groups anymore. We're talking about high-risk behaviors, and the virus doesn't know the difference.
Max?
I want to get back to the question I asked you a minute ago. The people who deal with death and dying are called thanatologists, and with all of the particular problems we have here, the fact it's a time bomb, the fact that now with increased testing, somebody may know that they're carrier of the disease, and they don't know when they're going to die or if they're going to die. And they may require, and their families may require, all sorts of kinds of counseling. And you were talking to the House Health Committee this morning about the high rate of accidental deaths in Alaska, very high rate nationally, for various causes. And people are living longer. Are you doing any studies or anything on whether there is adequate counseling for not only the people who are about to die themselves, or potentially, but families.
We haven't done any studies. We've recognized that that's a problem that needs to be dealt with, and that we need to find out how we best can do that. For several years, we've tried to direct our educational activities regarding AIDS to three major categories of groups. One, to the professional medical health counseling community. Two, the general public. And three, the high-risk behavior groups. And the type of information provided to those is different, obviously.
Thank you.
Representative Ellis.
Thank you. Are you familiar with the cover story in this month's edition of The Atlantic?
On AIDS.
On AIDS, yes. It was speaking, you were speaking earlier about behavior modification and, through education. And that article cites a number of studies, I guess among high-risk groups, and casts a lot of doubt on the utility of projects to modify behavior. Do you just have reason to doubt those studies, or were those studies done at a time when we didn't know much about the virus, or what would you say about that?
I'm not familiar with the studies they cited, but what we have are parallel evidence that the amount of other sexually transmissible diseases in those groups has fallen, at least in, say, homosexual, bisexual males. Now, intravenous drug users are a very difficult group to deal with, and whether behavior modification activities can be expected to have much impact, who knows? But certainly, one of the things that we hope to do is prevent recruitment of new individuals into that high-risk group. And among those individuals who are infected, we want to try to test their blood and counsel them and trace their contacts to again try to prevent transmission. Do we have great expectation that that's going to work? I think it's going to be an uphill battle all the way because of the compound problems of that group. But I think clearly in the groups of homosexual and bisexual males where the vast proportion of cases to this time have occurred, there's no question in my mind that behavior modification has already occurred and will continue to occur, and it can be very effective in reducing transmission in the future. But it's not going to be something that's going to be a one-time shot, and it's going to be something that we're going to have to do on an ongoing basis. And we're going to have to evolve these programs as we get future weapons. Perhaps we'll have a drug that, if someone were identified infected, might reduce the transmission of the virus. We want to make sure that then everybody got it. Obviously, if a vaccine became available, we jump to use it. As we know more information about risk factors, we might be able to apply those with a greater output for the investment. But now, it's very clear that our major opportunity is through this route of education and behavior modification, and it's the only thing we got.
Senator Josephson.
Thank you. You have presented a very bleak picture of the state of medical science, and I'm going to ask you the question that I suppose congressmen ask at NIH. We spend billions of dollars, you scientists have not come up with a virus, and you haven't even come up with a testing system that avoids the false positivity or the false negativity that you provide exist. So we're not happy consumers with you guys. I guess that's what it is. What is it that makes, when I was alarmed when you said, John, that you don't expect a vaccine to be marketable in 5 years or maybe 10. Why do you say that? I mean, are you getting reports from CDC or other places that hey, we're up against a stone wall here?
Absolutely. Scientific American, Science Magazine. Scientists say grim outlook or outlook bleak for vaccine development. The reason isn't because there aren't bright, brilliant people working on this. In fact, the amount of knowledge acquired in a short time is truly staggering. They've got DNA sequencing of the virus. The problem is that this virus shifts. It doesn't have a constant nucleic acid sequence of the DNA, which enables you to grab that and use that to make the vaccine, because that sucker changes and the antibodies don't recognize it. The other thing is this: a forefront of medical, pushing the forefront of medical research and technology. This virus invades the lymphocyte that kills weird infections. these infections that AIDS people acquire and die from are infections that hitherto were only seen on cancer wards among people who had an impaired immune system because their chemotherapy was knocking out these cells. It has to do with, why do we get cancer? What's the process of the aging of the human body? How does a virus infect an individual, and how can we kill the virus without killing the individual? The problem is that the hope was that by identifying the virus, that a sequence of the DNA would be identifiable as an antigen, could be modified not to cause disease, could be used then to produce a vaccine which would induce protective antibodies that would prevent infection. The virus isn't playing by the rules for that. Now, many attempts are being made to deal with that, but we're 5 years off. The scientists are saying it's at least 5 years before we could, based on current knowledge and research and expected research breakthroughs, have a vaccine that might work. Others are saying it could be 10 years. Others are saying it's never going to happen because of the type of infection the virus causes. Think of measles. There's a virus. It infects a person. They get over it. They never get measles again because those antibodies always subsequently neutralize the virus. The vaccine takes that virus. The virus is treated so it won't cause the disease. It's injected. The antibodies form. They kill the virus. So that's a simple, straightforward problem. Think of herpes virus. You get herpes virus, your body produces antibodies, but it doesn't kill the virus and eliminate it from your body, because if we draw the blood, get antibodies to the herpes virus, but the virus can come back and come back because it hides itself in nerve axons where the antibody and lymphocytes can't kill it. Now, the AIDS virus is one that induces antibodies. And we say, great, because the antibodies will kill the virus. But what we find, it doesn't work, because the people excrete the virus, they still have the virus, the virus continues to kill the T lymphocytes, which are crucial in killing these opportunistic infections that otherwise all of us don't get. But if we don't have those lymphocytes working for us, then our bodies fall prey to all of these opportunistic infections, and that's what kills people.
Okay, why don't we take a recess here. We have a 15-minute movie. I should explain this a little bit. It was produced by an outfit in New York called ODM Production Incorporated, and it's been endorsed by several national AIDS foundations. And this, there's about 1,000 copies of this movie being circulated throughout the United States. It has been shown on a very cautious basis at East High School in Anchorage. The school board committee that reviewed this film said that it had to be shown at the senior level only, and it had to be a speaker with introductory remarks that would stress abstinence is the best defense against contracting AIDS, and have a follow-up question and answer period, because it does bring up some questions that children in this age group would want to know. So we're going to take a 5-minute recess while Bob sets up the film, and take a look at the film, and if there are any further questions Dr. Goodall, we'll go to it at that time.
John? Doctor, for the record, why don't you go over your recommended budget for us?
And if you have any more questions, we'll get out of here.
Does everybody have a copy of that?
What we've done is tried to develop a proposed Alaska AIDS program budget, which we believe could help meet the needs to respond to AIDS, and primarily focused on two major areas. One is the support of our laboratory to be able to provide adequate testing of blood, and the other to try to work throughout the state to provide information about AIDS in the schools. To do that, we need to have support for the laboratory staff to do the tests and record those data. In the educational area, we think it's crucial to have a team of an education-certified person plus a health professional who can be a resource to our school districts and work with the school administrators, the PTAs, the local communities, the local school districts in order to arrive at appropriate curriculum and provide the support to develop and implement those curriculum throughout the state. And then we have support for our public health nurses so that they'll be able to provide the blood test screening and counseling throughout the state, and it's our goal to try to appreciably increase the screening. We have the travel necessary to support that, and then under our contractual proposal, one of the hopes that we would have is that we might be able to reproduce printing the Surgeon General's report and propose sending that out to all Alaskan households. It's estimated to be around 300,000. The Surgeon General's report is an excellent resource document and of impeccable credentials, and I think would be a very valuable adjunct to these other activities. And then finally, educational materials, that's developing the core curriculum and being able to respond to the districts. And I think that that the total sum of 698,000 you see here is actually what is required for us to meet the challenge. If we're going to get this program going now and take advantage of the opportunity we have, that's what it's going to take.
And you would like this to be a special program and the money to be, what's the word we use around here?
At home.
When you give money to somebody.
Granted.
Money to be granted to the Division of Disease Prevention.
Right, yeah, Division of Public Health, and the division can coordinate these activities and respond to implement the program.
Any questions? Max?
Yeah, Doctor, I'm wondering, on the $70,000 for printing and distribution, I was wondering if the federal government would have the extra copies just to give us.
Yeah, they don't. They provided us some, but basically what they've done is they've given us camera-ready negatives. The ones that we've handed out today, we've reproduced ourselves out of the limited funds that we now have available. You know, it's a nationwide problem, and there just hasn't been, up to this time, an adequate support to get going on these activities nationally. It's you know, clearly being addressed. I mean, these documents are very powerful documents for our country. But I mean, we just can't sit back and wait in the hopes that we're going to be able to nail down this kind of federal dollar support.
I saw a newspaper article where the Surgeon General is thinking about recommending that they condense the Surgeon General's report to the 8th grade level and send it out to all American households.
Good.
They may get around to it sometime.
Right.
We can't wait. Are you? Okay, after you finish that with the doctor, I've got a suggestion.
Okay, well, we'll open it up then. Max?
Do you have any... Do you know what you're going to do yet in the Senate on this?
Well, I think that we're going to get the committee together and ask the committee to go ahead and introduce the Dr. Goodhow's recommended program.
A special appropriation bill, supplemental.
Yes.
I'd like to work with you on that, and I don't know if I can speak on behalf of the committee. We've got the chairman here.
Certainly, we
be a committee bill.
Neil and I have been discussing this, but we should discuss it in front of the full committee.
Could we put that on the agenda? Do we meet tomorrow?
Well. Health Week is coming up next week, and that would probably be the time we could take it up.
Maybe we could work together, and if it's agreeable with you and the other co-chairman, I'll work with you to get a bill drafted, put it in the Senate, and put it in the House.
Okay, so you'll get the bill drafted?
I'll take care of that. Is that agreeable with you?
Senator Justin.
What role does the Department of Education have in this process?
Obviously, a very crucial one. We've already been working with the Department of Education and our department to try to get joint support for the implementation of the Surgeon General's recommendations. And our intent is to try to work very closely with the school board, the Department of Education, and with each school district in order to just start working to implement the recommendations as appropriate for each community. That's why we feel we have to have the a certified teaching health educator plus a health professional so we can combine the best of both of those professional areas to help implement the program and provide a technical support.
Mr. Chairman, does your work in Alaska indicate any
specific risk with prostitutes or the customers of prostitutes or commercial?
I think certainly there is that risk. Up until this time, of all the prostitutes that we know are prostitutes who have identified themselves as such and we've tested, none have been positive. And there's certainly great difficulty there, because if you test them, that only means they're not positive on that test, and there could be a negative, it could be infected the next day.
Max. Doctor, I heard that there were some cases in Fairbanks that resulted from a prostitute.
Not to our knowledge.
Okay, that's right. I have prepared an amendment that you're aware of that would require testing of people convicted of prostitution and related offenses, pimping and John, violating the John ordinance. And I gather from what you said yesterday that you have problems with that kind of mandatory testing. I don't know if the committees are interested in filling the hearing on that, but why don't you say that?
Yeah, I think that it would not be particularly effective. Our concern also that it might provide a sense of false assurance. And the difficulties both in terms of confidentiality issues, contact tracing issues, the practicality of the benefit, and then the inherent limitations in the test all make it problematic that it will actually provide a valuable additional effort to the others, and it certainly won't substitute for them. And I think that the that what I've just expressed is also was reaffirmed in this national meeting just 2 weeks ago, when many of these strategies related to mandatory testing of groups were looked at in depth. And we will be having actually written summaries of those discussions and the rationales and arguments that will be produced as a result of those meetings.
Dr. Minow, there's something you said earlier that I'd like to clarify. The accuracy of the antibody test that is used to cleanse the blood supply.
Right.
My understanding is that the inaccuracy is much more weighted to the false positive.
That's correct.
Than the false negative, that it was deliberately designed that way.
That's exactly correct. I tried to cover that, but I'm very happy to make that clear. You see, the price to pay to protect the nation's blood supply is to make the test sensitive, very sensitive, because if it's positive, we don't want that blood donated. We recognize by so doing there will be a proportion of individuals who are falsely identified as infected, false positive test results. We accept that price to pay because, in fact, those people aren't infected, their blood's safe. But in order to ensure that we don't allow individuals infected, so if we drop the sensitivity of the test, then it's possible that people who are infected with the virus wouldn't get picked up by that test because it wouldn't be sensitive enough. Their blood would get donated and then cause a problem. So the sensitivity of the test is established as very high. Again, it's an excellent test, both in terms of the sensitivity and the specificity. And the specificity is trying to ensure that those who are negative are negative. The problem is that when the test is applied to when the test is applied to a group with a high level of infection, it's extremely accurate and predictive. But when the test is applied in a mass sense to numerous individuals who are not infected, then those positives start to be false positives. And for each real positive, you get a couple of false positives just because the overall prevalence is so low. That doesn't just
occur. But there are backup tests.
Right. That just occurs with, not with AIDS, but with all tests. It's called Bayesian statistics, and it's an absolute problem that confounds everything from routine syphilis testing to routine chest x-rays to routine any test. But the goal of the test from its implementation in this country was to protect the nation's blood supply. And
if you get a false positive, though, isn't there an additional test or two that you can go through to?
Yes, when we get a false positive, then the test is repeated with the same methodology. And then if that's positive, the test is then run on what's called a Western blot test, which is a much more expensive and sophisticated test involving immunoconnectorelectrophoresis, which is a cumbersome laboratory service. It's also very expensive, and that we do routinely in order to confirm those positive results.
One more thing,
Senator.
Why? I heard that Japan had its first AIDS case this week. Maybe it's self-evident to some people, but can you sort of generally compare the American rate to the European or the Asian, and explain why some countries seem more involved with this now than others?
Sure. I think it's safe to say that every country in the world now has AIDS cases, and there's just questions politically about identification and official reporting. What was reported in Japan was the first female AIDS case, but the Soviet Union denied they had any cases for a long period of time, and now it's very clear that they have numerous cases. In the Atlantic Monthly article, there was the identification of the very serious problem of AIDS in the priesthood. And, you know, there's a serious problem in Africa, so serious that there is definite discussion of the collapse of their social structures because of the number of deaths that are going to occur from AIDS.
And the U.S. is on this scale?
Well, the U.S. is far better off than Africa, and I'd say it's very comparable to England and Europe. And it's difficult to be precise because our reporting and surveillance mechanisms are quite different, and in fact they're pretty sophisticated, especially for this disease. So the data are accurate here. I can't speak to how accurate they are elsewhere, but prevalence studies have been done, particularly in Africa, and so those data are quite accurate. But it's staggering, the amount of infection there. Half of the kids 2 years old are infected.
But isn't there also
In Zaire, I'm sorry, not in Africa, in Zaire.
Isn't there also something to the point that the disease has been active, the virus has been active in Africa longer than anywhere else?
Yeah, the belief is that this virus mutated in Africa and that it started to become infective there. And there are many reasons that it could be transmitted in Africa. There's scarification routinely, both of infants and of women for beautification, of men and women during puberty. There's in Africa, very frequent visitation of prostitutes by the males. Needles are reused there and are not sterilized, so one needle might be given to be successively used to inject drugs or vaccines to thousands of individuals, and there's no control. I mean, you don't have to be a physician to get a needle and all that kind of stuff. I worked for 6 months in Ethiopia as the only physician for 3 million people. We sterilized the needles, but we had to reuse them, and we had to constantly sharpen them because they become dull from going through the skin of so many people. We did not have the luxury of disposable needles.
Representative Hanlon.
Oh, I was just curious again about the blood supply. And I guess my question would be, if either one of your daughters or your children had to have a blood transfusion, would you have any reluctance to allow that to happen here in Alaska?
No, absolutely not because they're in Alaska. Now, you know, I'm an internist, and William Osler said that the charge to the internist was to keep your patients out of the hands of the surgeons. And you know, there actually constantly have been injunctions, very great concern. Blood transfusion has never been viewed as innocuous, but you don't usually give them for innocuous problems, and often you don't have any luxury about are you going to give a blood transfusion or not. Now, clearly, nationally, and for a long time, even before AIDS, there's a recognition of autologous blood transfusion for elective surgery. And what that simply means, if you know you're going to have elective surgery, you can go in, you donate some of your own blood, then that blood is banked. You see, and there's been tremendous advances. 10 years ago, when I was in training, we didn't have facilities to preserve every person's blood. It was very cumbersome. But that has been an advancement. Clearly, the safest blood is your own blood. And so there's a movement now to increase the availability of autologous blood transfusion. And, of course, depending on the amount of anemia, whereas perhaps some person would have transfused a unit of blood before, now, unless it's really viewed as essential to recovery, maybe that unit wouldn't be transfused. Maybe people would just say, well, you know, feel tired and dreary for a while longer and take iron, and your body will build it back, and you pay that price. But in terms of is Alaska's blood supply safe, my answer is yes, it is. That I would have very...
You
very
quoted some statistical odds yesterday.
Yeah, even before the screening program, programs were available, so back into the early 80s and before, so that there was no screening. The estimate was around one case of AIDS transmitted through a blood transfusion for around 3 million units of blood donated. Now, after the screening program became implemented, then that risk dropped, you know, a magnitude of power. I mean, I don't know what, but it's a very rare event. We have no known blood transfusion cases related in Alaska after our screening program was implemented. In rural Alaska, we've tested approximately 800 walking donors. Only two were positive. It turned out when we went back that both of those individuals, in fact, visited the place to get their test because they didn't have an alternate test site to go to. They had no intention of donating blood. They knew their members of high-risk groups. They simply wanted to have the test result back. The blood bank has screened, I had a data, 16,000, I believe, people. 16,468 donors have been screened in Alaska through January 1987. Only one individual was found to be positive upon repeat testing. In other words, they had a couple of dozen who were positive on the initial test. Some of those weren't positive on the next one. Only one was positive on all three tests. Obviously, none of those individuals' blood was allowed to be donated.
You about ready to get out of here, folks?
Yeah.
I have one quick question.
Other than this, do you see anything that needs to be done legislatively in our statutes or with respect to uniform statutes or multi-state agreements or with respect to suggesting steps be taken in other Western states or other states generally or to the Congress or internationally? What else should the legislature be doing other than this?
Is that 25 words or less?
Right.
Okay, very quickly. We're totally tied in. AIDS is a reportable disease in Alaska, and we're part of the national network with CDC, of which all the states are involved, for reciprocal notification of disease. And that's all been in place for several years and is working quite well. I would say that the only area that gives me some occasional heartburn is our confidentiality statutes. Now, I believe when I read our statutes, and in my career here as the state epidemiologist, that we have adequate safeguards inherent in our statutes and in our medical practice statutes to ensure the absolute confidentiality of these data. There are no case law. We have no cases in Alaska to interpret those statutes or to determine, in fact, that that would, in fact, hold up at a court case. So that I would say if there's one area that could be a potential great benefit to our successful attack on the transmission of this disease, it would be to absolutely ensure that we have provisions in our statutes for the express confidentiality and non-disclosability of the data.
Well, if you could have your Attorney General, who assists your agency, take a look at that, and let me know if there's a problem, and I'll pass it on to the other legislators, I'd be grateful.
I'd suggest something else. I was a radio report about this, which suggested that Alaska has a particular problem. You mentioned the walking people in the bush who were getting tested, but what I'm told is that in the rural and small villages, and even in towns like Wrangell or places like that, folks are reluctant to go in for testing because there's a lack of confidentiality. I mean, even if you go into the clinic and say, I want to have a test, I want to be screened for AIDS, it's going to get all over town, or your anxiety is it's going to get all over town, whereas it wouldn't be a problem in Anchorage or Juneau.
Obviously, we have a problem in small communities and with the easily identification of many problems. I've been here since 1975, and we've dealt with everything from syphilis and gonorrhea and chlamydia to toxic hazardous waste and everything. I have never known of a case documented where there's been a breach of confidentiality of patient identifying information in any situation. I think that we have anonymous testing. The only knowledge of an individual's status is between that individual and their physician or other healthcare provider. Our laboratory only receives a specimen with a number on it without an identifier. And for all of the experience that I've had, we have never had the disclosure, to my knowledge, of any breach of confidentiality of these sensitive data.
But would you agree that if Joe Smith lives in Hoonah or someplace, he might be reluctant to
report
to the local place for a test?
Oh, I absolutely agree with that. And that's why we're trying to set up this whole network of accessibility and availability of sites so that people who live in Anchorage, maybe they want to fly to Hoonah and be tested.
There were five groups in the movie: gays, needle users, blood transfusion, sex partners, and babies.
Right.
And the group that I think stands apart from the rest are the babies. And I'm wondering what steps can be taken to protect the babies.
They don't live very long, do they, Doctor?
Well, We don't know. One of the problems with AIDS virus is that AIDS virus directly invades the nervous system. And we don't know yet what's going to happen to babies because their immune systems are very different than adults. And so it's possible that, in fact, their immune system is going to enable them to survive longer so that they're going to end up with very serious neurological and central nervous system deterioration, but that their immune system is going to keep them alive. We don't know that yet.
I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
Oh, I was only going to say that of the 3,000 infants infected, almost all of them are born to intravenous drug using in AIDS infected women. And the critical task that we face is to prevent those individuals from becoming infected.
Are there any babies who have it in Alaska or have had it in Alaska?
Not to our knowledge. And statistically, that's no surprise, because with our relatively small population, you know, we would expect to go many years before we would expect to have, you know, a case. Almost all of the infants have been in New York City, northern New Jersey, in the IV drug-using population. And the other thing that has not been appreciated, or at least it's certainly not been well covered, is that almost all of the babies have been born to minority groups, and especially blacks.
Max, I don't know if you understand this, but it's very extraordinary for the Senate to work at night, especially after 7 o'clock. Now 8:30, as interesting as this is, I'm sure we can get Dr. Maddow down here again during the day.
Okay. I hear you. No further questions.
Okay.
Nothing else.